You're listening to Radio Golf Show. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Radio Golf Show. And ladies and gentlemen, every time a Golf Show All-Star returns to the program, it gives us tremendous joy and fills us with pride as it validates what we do, especially if it's someone of Sam Hunt's character and caliber. Sam is the CEO of Lab Golf. I'm personally thrilled that he has taken the time to visit with us today. Sam, welcome back to Radio Golf Show, you two-time All-Star, you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a blast. The first time, I'm glad to be able to have the opportunity to catch up with you again.
Yeah, there you go. And it's been quite a while. And we'd very, very modestly would like to think that we have played a small part in the rise of Lab, as the first time you visited with us was February 27th of 2023, which was less than 24 hours after Charles Howell won on the LIV Tour with one of your putters. Then we had Bill Pressey on July 1st, 2024, which was less than 24 hours after Richard Bland won the U.S. Senior Open with one of your stakes. Yeah, yeah. Today, obviously, the big news is out already. I think the biggest investment in golf history in a putter company, bigger than the Odyssey deal, and whenever that was, 1999. Obviously, you the headlines are a little bit misleading, I would think, when you read, you know, Lab Golf sold, and
right.
It's kind of like that album by The Who sells out, you know, with the baked beans thing on the cover.
Right.
It is far from that, isn't it?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's you know, the way that the story got out there was frustrating. We had intended to sort of tell the whole story all at once so that folks didn't jump to some of the conclusions, obviously, that they have around you know, what it means. But yeah, I mean, the intention to sort of have a transaction of sorts, the discussions internally began about 2 years ago. And you know, pursuing something like this is, you know, in many ways, that's the goal, right? You know, you have a product, and you want to bring it to the masses, and the best companies, I think, have, you know, a perfect marriage of recognizing that, you know, this is business, and we want to make money at our business, and then the equally a driving force being to just keep your eye on the goals of the company as it relates to the consumer, which is to, you know, make the best product we possibly can and help golfers enjoy the game a little bit more. I'm proud of the way that we've managed sort of, you know, both of those goals. And finding a partner that was going to allow us to do that was really hard. I mean, it was really, really, really hard. I think, you know, when we first started thinking about it, we were thinking about a minority transaction where sort of most of the goal was just to take some chips off the table. We've had some investors that have been along for the ride for, you know, a long time, and we don't, you know, we have been a profitable company for a while, but every dollar that we make just goes right back into the company. It wasn't to the point where we were, you know, sending out distribution checks every month or anything like that. And so it was time that everybody got a payday. And then over the course of those 2 years, so much about the business changed, including its needs. And now all of a sudden, you know, fast forward to 7 months ago when we first, you know, signed a letter of intent from L. Catterton, we needed more than just to take some chips off the table. We needed know-how. We needed infrastructure. We needed professionalization. We needed talent. And yes, we can do that stuff ourselves on some level. the cost associated with scaling every department simultaneously is significant, and that's because of the scale, right? It's not like, oh, okay, well, let's, make a new putter, and when we launch the new putter, we need, 500 units on the shelves like we did, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and then we'd kind of build as we go from there. Now, like, if we're going to launch a product, and that's just one little section of the business. If we're going to launch a product, we need to have 50,000 units on the shelves before they even launch. And that's just, it's a huge investment. And so, to be able to make those decisions without, one decision being without some of the decision-making process needing to be mutually exclusive, needing to choose one or the other, we can now do what we want. We can now, push every aspect of the business forward.
Well, you said you wanted to build a putter or a product and bring it to the masses. The way I like to think of it is much more romantic. To me, it looks like you guys just wanted to build a good putter, the best putter in the world, and the masses came to you.
I mean, I yes, I mean, that's absolutely right. And to be fair, it's not like we were ever, there was no point at which any, meeting, at the executive level was, how do we bring this to the masses? It was,
Exactly.
it's more just like we make putters, get a ton of inbound demand. It's like, okay, well, looks like people like the putters. How do we figure out how to make more of them? Because we now have more customers at the direct-to-consumer level, at the wholesale level, at the international level. And so yeah, I mean, I mean, I don't know. As I look back on it, I mean, all I really did was like just engage with the consumer. That engagement, ultimately combined with how profound the technology is, ultimately just created opportunity, whether it be sales, whether it's tour, whether it's a transaction or whatever. We just sort of kept our focus on just making badass putters, and the rest is kind of, this is way oversimplified, but has kind of taken care of itself.
But when you came into this business, the first thing I think you did, so you rebranded it from Directed Force to Lab, you can read many articles, and you always seem to say one thing: I really had no idea about the golf business. I had no idea what I was, and most of the people there with you didn't really either. Is that the secret to success? Is that what makes you authentic, and what gives it this something that the other guys don't have?
It was certainly a huge contributing factor. I mean, absolutely a huge contributing factor. And as you look at a lot of the sort of startup golf companies, they usually are folks that worked at other golf companies, that wanted, maybe they had their eye on a specific aspect of a product that they thought could improve, on a more boutique level, and but still end up kind of, utilizing the same contacts and the same marketing strategies and a lot of the same employees and all that. I mean, the employee horse trading that goes on within Carlsbad is wild, when you actually kind of get in the scene and understand what's happening. But yeah, there's no question but that having a room full of people that had no idea, how any of it works, gives you a completely blank slate, and all of us were golf consumers, big time golf consumers. We were all golf nerds with no actual, industry know-how at all. And so the problem solving and the infrastructure, the value creation, all that stuff was derived from people who were like, what do we want as consumers? Versus coming from a, what can we do to, make the most efficient dollar possible? It's really funny. I always used to use this analogy. As you know, we were talking about before we came on air here, I'm a musician, and one of my very favorite musicians in the world is a fellow named Tom Waits. And one of my favorite albums of his is an album called Mule Variations. And as an aside, there was an event that just took place up at a place called Gamble Sands. It was a Machinella event, and I was so excited to participate. And unfortunately, I couldn't. And then my heart broke even further when I got back and found out that the two guys from Lab that went up there, Liam Bedford and Carter Lee, played with the producer of Mule Variations in this event. And I was just, absolutely heartbroken. I didn't get to spend time with this guy. Anyway, one of the things that they did on Mule Variations was Tom would, grab his bass. He had access to extraordinary musicians because he was such a well-respected guy. And he'd, for some of the tunes, take his bass player and have him go play drums, and take his drummer and have him go play trombone, and have the trombone player go play banjo, so that you have these incredible musicians with, the mind of, a musician, but without the technical skills. And that's where you get some really cool raw stuff. If you look at most musicians, they generally write their best stuff the first 5 years that they know how to play the instrument, while it's all still fresh and original and feels new and vulnerable and scary. And so that was kind of like Lab, is that all of us were certainly passionate musicians, all, good players and experienced consumers. But, we're also vulnerable and afraid and, and curious. And I think all of those different attributes allowed us to do everything differently in the way that we do things, the connection with the consumer, the custom options, the technology itself. These are all different things. And if it was a company that was run by a bunch of industry professionals, it just would have gotten watered down. I know it would have. So I think that's a lot of the magic. Is it the key to a successful product? I don't know.
You said a bunch of interesting things. Number one, I mean, band or musicians or bands do their, well, there aren't really any bands anymore. They do their best work in the first 5 years, and then they get picked up by a big record label, and they start doing things that the record company thinks the people want. They're not doing what they want. And I'm sure Tom Waits never made music for the audience. He always made it for himself, I would imagine.
Oh, for sure. No question. And I think there's also, like, at least in music's case, I don't know that this necessarily translates to the golf industry. There's, like, it's not a coincidence. When, being a young person in the world is hard, particularly when you're an artist and there's no obvious avenue for you to have a life. And I think a lot of that pain and struggle ultimately makes for some great art. And then when things become a little less painful and a little less struggling, I think it's hard to to continue doing it. I was a musician, and, like, I'm removed enough from that, the version of me 25 years ago that was writing music, that I don't feel any, I don't feel like I'm tooting my own horn too much. But my songs were good. I mean, they were really good. I was a talented songwriter, and I was good at arranging music. And then, as I got a little older and, got married and had some kids and had some stability with, my job, like, all of a sudden I really didn't have that much to write about. Once the pain went away. And that's when, and to your point, I think that once you get past that sort of, dare I say, hormonal stage of writing, when you're, wide-eyed and optimistic in your early 20s, and I think for most people, it gets harder to create unless you're one of just the fewer ones, people who just need to create, otherwise their souls start to wither. And I think Tom is certainly one of those.
Well, I mean, once you start making stuff, what you think other people like, it's not art anymore, it's commerce.
Correct.
You know,
That's
so
exact. That's a great way to put it.
and you still own a club in Eugene? Is that still going?
I do. I don't
What
know
is
how
the
much
name of that
longer.
joint?
It's called the Blair Alley Vintage Arcade. It was sort of a dual passion marriage in the partnership. So my background was in music and in promoting venues and talent buying and all that. And then I partnered with a fellow who was, I mean, really, as much as anything, passionate about the 80s. But among the things within 80s culture that he loved so much was arcade games, pinball machines, and stuff like that. So it's a huge place. We're actually about to do a little expansion that has a ton of old vintage arcade and pinball machines, but then as well as a massive stage and a dance floor. And then we also have a stage outdoors adjacent to the venue. So in the summertime, we get to do some really, really fun shows.
There you go. And you said you were a songwriter and a musician yourself, but I understand you're also in the talent scout business.
Correct. That was how it all started for me. When I was a musician, this was kind of I was I it, both the recording and performance side of things had yet to be fully digitized. So like the early records I recorded were still on analog. I just started to use some Pro Tools towards the end. And then on the booking side of things, when I first started booking tours for bands, it was still, snail mail press kits with a picture and a CD in it. There was no, the way to pass this stuff around digitally. And so it was a huge pain in the ass. And I realized, like, if I was willing to deal with the pain in the ass, I could hire some, or I could find some of these, young bands that are talented, but certainly didn't have the know-how or the discipline to make 400 phone calls a day to try and find venues willing to host them. And so I started a talent agency, parlayed that into booking talent for some venues here in town, here in Eugene, and helping out with some festivals that happen in the area. And then when I found the opportunity with Blair Alley and with my partner Chad over there, we opened up that spot, and that was sort of all I did after that. I didn't do any more talent buying beyond what we were doing at the venue.
But ladies and gentlemen, you can go and visit that performance space, and I'm sure you'd still keep an eye on some bands that nobody knows that people should maybe know. So,
To the best that I'm capable, if I'm honest, I have so little to do with it anymore. And I went down there and saw some act that I'd never heard of. It was really good, and I realized, like, oh, okay, I'm out of the loop here. I've never heard of these guys. I don't even know how I'd define this music. I am now officially old.
There you go. When you came first on the show in the February of 23, and it was that day after the Charles Howell won on the Live Tour, a bunch of stuff has happened since then. I mean, it's more and more players are playing the lab putter. I assume you're still not paying people to play your putters like you did back then.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up doing a deal with Adam, which felt really, really good, just because he's been such an instrumental part of our success, and he was certainly entitled to reap the benefits of that which he helped create. And yeah, that's definitely one of the sort of use of funds, questions that was asked when we did this transaction. We'd like to get into being able to get these players what they deserve for helping us out the way they have, and to help them continue with their journeys. A lot of those efforts are going to be made at lower levels, Korn Ferry, and even at the amateur level to help develop players. And then, we're still trying to figure it out. Just like everything, we want to do it a little different. Like I think the days of a PGA Tour superstar getting on to a commercial and saying, I use a so and so driver and so should you, like I don't see many consumers buying a product because of an endorsement from a player. There's no question there are certain players that still move the needle and get people interested. But our whole marketing strategy was about making sure that the customers were the heroes. So the partnerships that we want to have, with tour players hopefully can support that ethos, like tour players out there trying to help you, not saying buy it because I use it. So finding the right, PGA Tour partners to do that is a little tricky. But we've got our eye on a few partnerships that hopefully materialize, and you'll see some of the stuff that we do with them. And additionally, part of the opportunity that we now have, like I said, is to help them. And so, everybody just assumes, like, oh, if they're a PGA Tour player, they're millionaires and da da da. Like, unless you're one of the, like, consistently one of the top 25 players in the world, like, it's a grind, man. Like, it is a grind. And like, yes, they make a lot of money. You couldn't believe how much money they have to spend in order to just stay capable of playing golf at a high level.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're trying to figure out some performance-based stuff, you know, and rather than just media-facing stuff, for instance, you know, there's a an entity out there that has software that allows you to, you know, see like that tracks specifically how often your logo is visible on TV, and there are some contracts being worked out, you know, where it's, you know, 50 cents per mo, you know, whatever per second that it's, or $5 per second that it's on TV, who knows, whatever the metric is. And like, I didn't love that because, like, you know, I we've got some guys using our putter who aren't necessarily the ones that the camera's going to check out, who are playing extremely well, versus some guys who don't play so good, but the camera, you know, they always seem to end up in the featured groups. And you know, we want to support the guys that are pushing themselves. And so we're working on figuring that out, and hopefully we'll come up with something creative, and that's a little bit different than you know, than we've seen in the past with traditional endorsement deals.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just yesterday in the final grouping of the Women's Open, the Korean player A.L. Kim, I believe her name is,
Alum, yeah.
was using one of your sticks, and
Dude, she's great. She
yeah,
is
and you know, she's called
so
Korean,
good.
and it's like, you know, and then this putter with, you know, I mean, and they're very hard to miss, your putters, when you I mean, you can tell immediately. So you're not like, what kind of putter is that? You know immediately it's a lab.
Right.
But I think rewarding a player, when you said you rewarded Adam, it's completely the opposite of paying somebody to play your stuff. So
Oh, totally.
again,
We're not going to do anything with anybody that isn't like totally all in.
and you got a bunch of guys. I mean, JJ Spawn. I mean, what that must have been for you, I don't know. But then you think as an outsider, you know, and it's portrayed like that in the media, that was the moment Lab decided, are we going to find an investment company? But it wasn't. I mean, the aha moment that this is something really big must have come at a much earlier time. Do you remember that moment when you were sitting at home and you said, damn.
I mean, I would say it's been a pretty gradual and steady stream of aha moments, you know. I mean, the moments for me, the validating moments for me, generally aren't the ones that the general public notices. And yes, I mean, anybody who thinks that PE companies started calling us after JJ Spawn had won the Open, or that's not how it went down. I mean, we were, if anything, it was frustrating that like the valuation of the company had already been determined 7 months prior. You know?
You know, I
it
thought when I saw the
was
number, I thought, I said, that's a pretty good deal. That's a pretty good price. It's cheap. It was
it's
200
uh
million or something
it
like
was
that.
the, it was a very fair deal on both sides. You know, there's no question there's still plenty of risk in the putter business, and as the competition is coming on strong, you know, there's it was a totally fair price. But no, it didn't have anything to do with JJ, other than as we were in the closing stretch working out the deal, it just helped everybody feel real good here.
And then the story with, you know, making, you know, five over after six holes, and the kid at the pharmacy in England, in Scotland, not Scotland, in Oakland.
It was like the
Oakland.
most lab major victory that
It
ever
was
was. You know, like
incredible.
it was
Incredible. It's
just
like
like
these things.
everything we do. It was ridiculous. But no, I mean, the aha moments, like, you know, I get scared sometimes, like they're, you know, sometimes we get a, you know, just a little stuck in our own world here, you know. And the day-to-day grind of running this company, sadly at my level, you know, with the job that I have, I try to keep it as about putting as I possibly can, but there are just simple realities of running a business that demand my attention, and that certainly take my focus off of the customer and off of putting. And it's just so cool, the connections, the direct connection and access that we have to our customers makes it so that every single day there is somebody writing saying, I was just about done with golf, and then I found your putter and it's fun again. And those are the aha moments. That's when we know, you know, what's going on. And sure, when a JJ Spawn wins, you know, makes a 64 footer, it's so nice to, you know, to have the world see that story. But the growth vet lab has experienced, the validation that we've experienced, it didn't come from Lucas Glover. It didn't come from JJ Spahn. It certainly helped, and it's such a cool headline part of the story. But the real growth, the real ahas, the real journey that we've been on is a direct result of the fact that our customers have done all of this for us. The guys at your club that are out there making putts when they didn't used to, that's why we've grown the way that we've grown. It ain't because of the tour stuff specifically.
Absolutely. Was and then you at some point you must have thought, Jesus Christ, we can't make these things fast enough. And there were people complaining left and right about the lead times and things like this. And probably, for me personally, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, if you go order a pair of custom-made shoes, the guy will call you when they're ready. He's not going to say pick them up in 2 weeks. So, if that's what you want, you got to wait for it. And then the customization, and we talked about it last time a little bit about the fitting and about the minute differences in the fitting and the many thousands of different configurations, really, that you can bring there would certainly make it worth my while to wait for it. But now along comes not only Al Catterton, but I'm sure a bunch of other PE firms, and immediately you think of Michael Douglas in Wall Street and these kind of assholes who just want to try to gut the thing, cut it in pieces and sell it and whatever, and nobody really wins except them. How did you go about that? I mean, people knock on your door and say, "Hey," or do you go out and say, "Hey, we want to talk to you about this?" Walk us through that process.
It was a little of both. Early on, we'd had people reaching out all the time wondering if they could invest. And usually when somebody's writing as an individual saying, "Can I invest?" it's not a significant number that they're necessarily thinking of. And so but there were we had a couple of, great customers that are high net worth individuals that we reached out to see if they'd be interested in, doing something a little bigger here and there. And there was some interest. At the same time that we were hoping to sort of syndicate a group of people that we know, customers and stuff like that, we realized we needed more than cash. We needed, actual help. And so we did end up hiring an investment banking firm to help us, both find us a good buyer as well as usher the transaction, which is just I can't even overstate how big a pain in the ass having a transaction is. It's just nothing I'd ever want to experience again, frankly. It's just absolutely brutal. But yeah, we hosted any number of PE firms or different types of groups out here at the factory. They come out, they take a tour, they meet with us for a few days and hear about our ambitions and our plans and the strengths, the weaknesses, and they sort of try to sell us on how they can help. And look, for the most part, the PE world is they're there to make money. They're not, it's not a charity, it's not a, whatever. But within that space, that doesn't mean that they all have to be Michael Douglas. And or what was his name in the movie? Gordon Gekko. And we had a number of Gordon Gekko types come, and it was the good news is they might as well have a blinking red light on their head saying, "Don't do this with me if you actually give a shit about your company, because we're going to destroy it." And you can tell, I mean, within minutes, truly minutes, like you can see, what these people are made of and what their ideals are, what their values are. And then finally we met Al Catterton, and they were, I've said this in a few other interviews, they were literally the only PE company that came into the building that did not mention the timeline in which they were going to flip the company within the first 20 minutes of being there. And in fact, they didn't really talk about the flip at all. And sort of kind of like us at our level and with our specific product, keep your eye on the prize, make badass putters, treat your customers really good, and the rest of the shit will take care of itself. Bill Catterton was much the same way, which is like, yes, of course, we eventually want to make money on this investment. The way that we're going to do that is by making sure that you guys remain on track to grow the way that you're growing, maintaining the lab ethos, both internally and externally. And so, look, I mean, especially with like the competition that's come after us, ain't there yet. They have there's some nice single models out there with, a single lie angle or maybe a couple and a few different lengths and whatever, but they're not there yet. And so anybody that's going to invest in us would be idiots to not consider that the value of our company is the stuff that we're already doing, which you can't cheapen. You just can't do it. There's no way to cut corners and get cheaper materials and do all this stuff and still do what we do. And so Alcatraz completely understands that. So their intention with us is to continue to nurture what it is we do rather than pivoting towards some sort of mass production model. It just they know as well as anyone, it'll just crash and burn. That's just to be the quickest way to kill the brand. And it's so funny too, listening to all the comments and everybody, it's like, these people are not idiots. They're like, I mean, literally some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life, some of the most well-educated people I've ever met in my life. And when you get into that sort of upper echelon of people in those fields, like they go beyond just having technical business acumen, of which they're incredibly educated and have all that. They also have incredible personalities and incredible instincts, to read between the lines. That's how they've been as successful as they have for over 30 years. I mean, like, and look at their background. I mean, the brands that they've, helped grow, they're premium brands, and they understood just as they do with us, like, we're not going to start, they do Birkenstock.
Birkenstock. Yes, I was just going to say
Yeah, I
Birkenstock.
mean,
That
they're
is
not going to come
true.
out and start, looking for cheaper, materials to make Birkenstocks. No, if anything, you make it more high quality. And so that's what we're excited to work with them for.
For those who don't know, Alcatraz is a division of LVMH, the Bernard Arnault, Louis Vuitton, Moët, three letters my wife loves, and then the H, the Hennessy is maybe for me. Like you said, Birkenstock and Peloton, that bicycle machine and things like this. So they really, it seems like really, really good partners for you. But let's also make one thing clear. You did not sell the company. It sounds to me
No,
like it's a
we sold
partnership.
a majority interest of the company.
But it's a
I
partnership.
still have, oh, for sure, it's a partnership. And like, I think it's also important for people to know that a huge amount of the proceeds that I personally made on this transaction, I put back into the company. I'm betting on them and they're betting on us. And so, yes, this is absolutely a partnership. They are not operators, nor do they have any interest in being operators. They want to support us to do our thing. The factory is staying right here in Cresswell. Our existing management team is in place. We're certainly going to expand it. No. This is absolutely a partnership. And when we want to, there's sort of different, there's sort of a, 30,000 foot, 10,000 foot, and 1,000 foot view of our operations, the things that are going on. A lot of the 30,000 foot stuff, we just simply didn't have the bandwidth for. And so now we do. Now we're going to have both the financial resources as well as the personnel to execute on some incredible plans that we have for the future.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how that payday will change or changed the disruptor Sam Hahn. Did you go out and buy yourself something?
I did. I bought myself my girlfriend lives up in Bend, and which is about 2.5 hours from here. And so I bought a place for us to move into, or for her and her daughter to move into, that we could be at together up there. And so that was the big one for me. Other than that, a friend of mine, texted me the other day, and he was like, "Now that you're loaded, make sure you don't turn into too much of a douchebag." And I said, "The good news about not really having a terribly strong concept of money is that I don't know how much of a douche to be or to not be. So I mean, even for the last few years, I've been, paid well enough here as CEO that like that part of my life, I've already met all of any of the goals that I'd ever, hoped for. And I'm not a particularly flashy guy. I like nice things. Somebody was asking me like, what am I going to spend the most money on? It's like, it's not things. It's mostly conveniences,
Yeah,
like
there you go.
like no longer having to think about whether or not I should go grocery shopping or just Grubhub. I Grubhub now. things like that, just to make life a little easier and a little smoother. But no, kids get to go to college for sure without having to worry about going into debt on that stuff.
Is a
And
life-changing amount, I would
absolutely.
imagine. And it's kind of the Victor Hovland approach of hey, I don't need most of this stuff. I mean,
Right.
my kids are not going to remember what kind of car we have, but they're going to remember the family trips we go on. So,
Exactly. You spend the money to create time.
exactly.
And yeah, I was at, I ended up at a charity event I was speaking at, and usually in the past when I've done things like that, I speak and then, I go in the back and that's that. But I raised a paddle on a charity auction for a
You
trip to
go.
Italy. And but yeah, I'm gonna do some traveling for sure. And
Great.
but and as much as anything, I'm excited to invest in any opportunities that Lab creates, and to invest in other opportunities within golf and within the space that I know, and hopefully have the opportunity to help out people with similar ambitions as we did.
Yeah, but before we talk about some possible changes at Lab, what this bring what this investment may bring with it, what's going to change for the customers, and maybe particularly for the customers overseas, because now you will have, I guess, other distribution channels. You'll be able to manufacture quicker. You will still, I remember 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, you made everything in Oregon.
Yeah.
Is it?
So the top line changes that you're going to see is faster and higher quality and more accessible. And so, doing everything out of Oregon, which by the way is like geographically the worst place on planet Earth to have a golf manufacturer. I mean, it just shipping everything certainly to Europe is forever away, and it's tough. And so, the working plan would be to set up satellite custom factories in certain parts of the globe that are lab, not distributors, actual lab employees manning custom shops, so that a lot of the custom orders will A, be made faster, shipping will be cheaper, and the custom experience, the process, like if you're somebody from Thailand trying to do the remote fitting through the website and communicate, through one of our guys here in Cresswell with the time change differences and everything. It's a mess. And so everybody's going to have a lot more access to the process. And in theory, everything should ship faster and higher quality. There's we are expanding our manufacturing to every aspect of the manufacturing. So currently, the vast majority of our heads are made about an hour and a half south of here, at a machine shop called Nick's Machine Shop, multi-generational machine shop, and they've been amazing for us. And
Excuse me, Nick's machine.
Nick's Machine, NIX, Nick's Machine Shop. Yeah, it's they're great. Honestly, every time I go there, I think I'm lost, and it looks like just this giant barn in the middle of absolutely nowhere, Oregon. And then you go inside, and it's like the most sophisticated, machining you'll find anywhere in the world. And they've been incredible partners to us, but the needs, we've also started manufacturing some putters in Mexico, and I was adverse to offshore or nearshore manufacturing, not necessarily specifically because of patriotism as much as I'd love to continue to feed the American economy. My concern was the quality. My concern was that we wouldn't be able to find partners that did it as high quality. And with some of the talent we have in the building now, who are able to go source other partners overseas or near shore, we found incredible partners. So I mean, these folks that are helping us in Mexico, so they built us our own building from scratch, and it's state of the art. I mean, it looks infinitely more professional than our factory floor downstairs. And our guys go down there, a couple times a month, for, perpetual training on stuff. It's a very limited number of people that are doing it. And then all of those putters still come through our factory here in Cresswell. But that's what's enabled us to make stock putters at a much higher clip. And when they're helping us with the stock stuff, which are a little easier to manufacture, given that it's two lengths and a single lie, now we can really focus on the custom stuff here and do it faster and not have to, wait, months and months and months for your product. But, I totally understand the consumer's skepticism on some of this stuff. I think that we all have, myself included, major predispositions that something not made in America isn't going to be as good. And that's simply just not the case, particularly with technologies the way they are, materials the way they are. And as much as I would have loved to have kept everything in the United States, like, the US simply isn't set up for that kind of scale. So if we were going to do this in the US, like, we would be looking at 10 different machine shops to manage, which is, it's just too much. And then you start to get inconsistencies, between one manufacturer or another, where it's just not doable. As soon as it is, I'll be all over checking out those opportunities and making sure they make sense for the company. But in the meantime, yeah, we're finding some great partners that are going to help us increase our capacity, increase our quality, and increase, consequently, customer service. So all that stuff was also, by the way, already well in the works long before this deal closed with Elkhart. This is not their doing, other than to say that they wanted to make sure we had a plan in place to scale before they wrote a big check.
Did you have one thing going into these negotiations with some of these sharks? Was there one thing on your mind that was absolutely not negotiable?
Yeah, Cresswell and our employees and the culture here. Full stop. I mean, there was just absolutely zero consideration that they would change our operation in any significant way. So yes, that was thing one. And then, honestly, just that sort of holds the rest of the concerns at bay. Cheapening the product, cheapening the marketing messages. Yeah, I mean, I definitely wanted to make sure that the culture that we had created, both internally and as importantly externally, was maintained. And so if you make that a full stop, non-negotiable, then any number of decisions underneath that sort of need to get held through the, okay, is this going to fuck up the lab culture? If it doesn't, we go forward, and if it does, we don't. Or, I'm sorry, if it screws it up, we don't do it. So that was important. And I mean, to be fair, most of the companies, I don't know how it actually would have shook out, because a lot of them I just straight didn't trust. But there wasn't too many that were coming in here pitching us on the idea of installing new management and, new stuff. I mean, this is a weird company, and it'd be a very interesting person that would come in to think that they can take this business model and really make it that much better.
Now, without getting into the technicalities, we spoke about this at length in our first podcast, with the Liang balance and the zero torque or no torque or whatever. And I also spoke with Bill Pressey about that. There seem to be a lot of guys out there now who are pushing these zero torque things.
Yeah. First, I'll say I'm really disappointed. And I'll take some responsibility for this, but I'm pretty disappointed that the industry has decided to call the whole category zero torque. Nomenclature and naming conventions just happen so quick. And the media just insists on categorizing things in a way that requires the least amount of explanation. I understand that instinct. You don't have, the attention of, a given reader for that long. We don't want to make things too complicated, but this was a mistake. It was a mistake to call the category zero torque. And let me be more specifically clear. Lab golf putters are not zero torque. There is absolutely torque in the head. It is what we call corrective torque. The putter is actually torquing to seek square, but it is not zero torque. So let's say, we put this putter here. Let me see if I can adjust my camera so that you can see it. But all right, so I've got my can of what I call Vietnamese crack coffee, I call it. This isn't, putter's not going to sit perfectly toe up just because of my desk and this can, but it's here. And now if I rock it, it's going to find its way back, to that toe up position. That by definition is torque. A true zero torque putter would mean I could turn it like this and it would just stay there. I could turn it like this, it would just stay there. Turn it like this and it would just stay there. That's zero torque. There are almost no putters on the market right now that are actually zero torque. Most of them have some amount of what we're calling creative torque, and the vast majority of them have way too much corrective torque. And then an even greater majority have just inconsistent torque biases, period. Like they're just kind of all over the place. A lot of the, particularly one of the major manufacturers, that released their competitive version of our putters earlier in the year. I mean, we put them on our balancers here, and some of them hang like this, some of them hang like that, some of them are toe up, some of them are fast rotation, some of them are slow. They're just kind of all over the place. And that's just because the reality is the fact that you just can't mass produce these things. You got to get your hands on them and actually and actually dial them in. And I would say that our now, I mean, look, we've been at this. Bill's been at it for 12 years. We've been at it, about 8 years now, and we know more. We just know more about the technology than anybody else out there. They're playing catch up. They wanted to get something to market. Some of them have done really good jobs with their putters, some of them not so much. It is definitely a competitive environment, and we are certainly more than we were a year ago, real stoked about the competition. There's been, you were asking about different accelerators of our growth. There has been no greater accelerator to our growth than the competition.
Absolutely.
As soon as all these major companies validated that we ain't selling snake oil and that the technology actually works, everybody's like, okay, I'll give Lab a chance.
And what makes me shake my head is that some of these people walk around like they invented the goddamn thing. There's no torque thing. It's unbelievable.
This, yeah, the
I mean,
some of them have been classier about it than others. And it certainly has exposed to me. Yeah, man. I mean, I'll tell you what, even from afar, like while we were technically competitors, because there wasn't putters in the same category, as a consumer, I still looked up to these companies. Like I looked up to their marketing departments, to their R&D departments, and even their executives. And like I just assumed they were doing things better than we do, just because they've been around for so long and they have so much talent in the building and everything. And the way that these putters came to market and the marketing language that surrounded them and everything was like monumentally disappointing. I mean, just legitimately saddening as a consumer to realize how much absolute just bullshit that these companies feed the consumer without a shred of ethics around what it is that they are trying to communicate to their consumer. It was really, really, really disappointing. Ultimately advantageous to Lab, because our whole thing is being as transparent as we possibly can about everything that we do. And I think that that's a scary prospect for a lot of these OEMs to actually be honest about what it is that they're doing.
And it looks like they're just making them more expensive to pretend that they're better.
100%.
What how many putters do you make a month right now?
I think we shipped like 35,000, 37,000, something like that, in July.
And that is at the limit of your capacity of your factory, what you have right now. Has
Correct.
construction, when will the construction of new facilities, the construction facilities begin?
Fairly soon here,
Production
and
facilities.
even still, we know that we need to increase our capacity here as well. So there'll continue to be major gains in our ability to ship from Cresswell here. I believe we are targeting capabilities of 50,000 a month by end of February. So that'll be hugely helpful. The major moves helping to get some of these satellite factories up and running are going to begin in earnest. Beginning of next month.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating story, and one of our favorite golf show all-stars, Stuart Burley from Holland, is actually now importing the labs into Holland. So we encourage our European listeners to get in touch with Stuart Burley, who used to build putters himself. I have one of his in my bag. Not doesn't really work for me, but he's a super guy, and I'm glad that they, well, you got a good guy in Holland. That's for sure. Sam, the last time you were here, you told us that I listened to a couple of things, and I usually never listen to these shows, but two things I found in my notes. You said you would like to play your last round by yourself with the golf gods. And you said that in the case of a karaoke event, you would belt out Chumbawamba's Tub Thump.
Oh God, that was not my finest moment.
I thought it was pretty cool. I personally love having followed this journey, and it's just beginning. It's terrific. It's what many of us who have good ideas, and obviously you guys have brilliant ideas, that don't know, aren't really good at monetizing this stuff. It gives me great pleasure, and it gives me hope that at least if I know some people who don't know how to monetize things, and then something like this happened, there's always hope. So we wish you from Germany nothing but the best, you and the whole company there. And any job, when you work the way I got to know you now, a job is truly never finished. And
No.
I hope that this little event that happened reaches a stage where it can be kind of left on its own for a little bit for you to enjoy it as well. I think
Oh, for sure.
one of the things you wrote when JJ Spaun won, "Drink It Up," and it reminded me of Warren Zevon, "Eat every enjoy every sandwich." And that's what I wish you and your family and all the guys at Lab. So thanks very much for today. We'll keep following you, and we'll have you back. And let's just hope that the lab will not work so well in the Ryder Cup, because
Oh, it's going to dominate.
it's gonna dominate. Well,
We got a pretty strong team at a pretty intimidating venue, so
you do. You
I would not be I wouldn't be betting on I wouldn't be betting on a European victory for this one.
we never do either, but
Oh,
sometimes
you should have the last decade anyway.
no
There's
chance.
you guys outplayed the underdog thing for way too long.
Well, at least you got
Way
one
too
lap
long.
at the Ryder Cup.
Yep, we got JJ, and so hopefully he'll do pretty well. I haven't seen the European list yet, but I don't think we've got any on there.
There isn't that. It's more of an American thing, right? And it's more a like you said, a Korn Ferry challenge towards
Oh,
people.
you'd be actually our largest numbers this year actually took place in the DP.
Oh, wow.
We had I think we had multiple events that we had 18 putters in play. Our guy Tom Murray over there has done an unbelievable job growing the presence over there. And one of my favorite things about that is that I'm always trying to get the guys into colors, to pop a little bit more on TV. And all the guys in the estates are all like black at gray at best. Like JJ would actually prefer not to have a gray one. He wants a black one. And then all the European guys got the colors. They all got the oranges and the cappuccinos and the blue ones and everything. So
Yes.
hopefully maybe in a couple of years we'll have a couple of pretty colors on the Ryder Cup team.
There you go. We look forward to it, and obviously you can. We'll ask you to come back again, and keep us up to date on what you guys are doing, because it's fantastic. It's good to be a disruptor, an outlier, whatever you want to call it, to do things different. And you, sir, are certainly doing it. Thank you very much for your time, Sam.
Thank you, Frank. Have a good one.
Be well. To the links land.
Bye-bye.